quiet your way? No, it's busy as a bee.
Very busy.
Good. Had a wonderful keynote speaker to get us thinking about the Southern Jews and the civil rights. My name is Lily Filler. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm one of your vice presidents. It's a pleasure to be here today. It is also my distinct honor to introduce a trailblazer, a remarkable individual, and a wonderful role model, Gene Tolle.
That's enough.
All of us will recognize the name as the first female Supreme Court Justice in the state of South Carolina. December 31st of this year of 2015, and when I asked her how she would like to be introduced or if she had anything to add to that, she said, "I abide by Shakespeare. Brevity is the soul of wit." So I'm going to stop there and say, welcome, Chief Justice Tolle.
Thanks very much. Let's see here. We'll get this turned on. There we go. Thanks very much, Lily, and to the South Carolina Jewish Historical Society for putting on what's going to be a remarkable day and a half of discussion on this very rich topic, courage, conscience, and conformity, South Carolina Jews and the Civil Rights Movement. Today, rising to the challenge, Jewish politicians in an age of change. Today, many of us want to go back in history and find Southern Jews whose social conscience departed from regional norms. Yet a look at the past shows that Jews conforming to the dominant racial mores constituted a lot of the population at that time. Along with other native white Southerners, they bought and sold slaves before the Civil War. They went along with Jim Crow, were hesitant to march for black liberation, and did not welcome Jews from the North who came south to take part in voter registration drives. How do those realities square with the Jewish experience as a historically persecuted people? Have attitudes and actions changed in recent times? We have a wonderful group of panelists who can tell you the stories of those who, in the words of Harriet Keisling, went against the tide in the Jewish community. Thanks, Lily. This better?
Yeah.
Very good. So it's my pleasure to briefly introduce your panel, and then we'll get right to it. Marvin Layer has been a civil rights and human rights activist in South Carolina and in Columbia for many, many years. He came to Columbia in 1969 to head up an interfaith, interracial group that was kind of the successor to the group I was in 1961 when I witnessed at what became known as the Edwards versus South Carolina March around the State House, the first Amendment look at the rights of oppressed black people, particularly in the South. Marvin's career is so distinguished with service both at the Department of Social Services and in other state agency involvements, but very predominantly in so many civil rights organizations. He's been recognized nationally. He's been able to achieve grants and interest in South Carolina by everyone from the Kellogg Foundation to you name it in the private world that have invested in South Carolina's continued struggle to achieve racial equity in South Carolina. That's Marvin Layer, who on the side has also worked hard for affordable housing, for drug treatment, Meals on Wheels, improved health care for the elderly, and every other good thing you can think of in our community. Marvin, thank you for participating. Joel Lurie probably needs no introduction to any group that understands a man who inherited yearning for justice and public service. I had the privilege of serving with Isidore Lurie, his father, for many years in the General Assembly, and Joel has taken that incubator of leadership experience from his mother Susan and his father Isidore and taking it to new heights. We are really viewing with very mixed feelings Joel's decision not to reoffer for election to the South Carolina Senate. But his spirit of community activism won't be limited simply by not being in the South Carolina Senate. But meanwhile, he's been recognized locally and nationally by every group that talks about caring for other human beings, whether it be protection and advocacy for people with disabilities, whether it be the National Transportation Safety Board for his very groundbreaking work on mandatory seat belts, whether it be advocacy for the mentally ill, the governor's nuclear waste task force, autism, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, you name it. There isn't a decent or good cause that he doesn't prick the conscience of the South Carolina General Assembly with his advocacy and his latest efforts at stopping very foolish legislation that is going to condemn North Carolina to a place they don't want to be in. Joel Lurie is South Carolina's protector against falling back after we've just gotten rid of that flag on the dome and joined the mainstream of American life. Joel will keep us there. Jack Swerling, my hero. This is a man with a small practice that has an outsized influence on criminal law and the stability of our court system in the time that he has been in practice. He started with some of the greats, and he reminded me not only with Isidore Lurie, but with Mr. Levy and Mr. Wittenberg. He had a rich training by wonderful mentors before he struck out on his own and formed his own law firm. In addition to being South Carolina's premier criminal defense lawyer, Jack has found time to be a member of the board examiner, bar examiners, one of the people that writes the bar exam and grades it for practically no pay every year, year after year, without complaint. He's headed the Bridge the Gap program, teaching young people to make the transition from law school to practice for over 35 years. He has been a member of the Chief Justice's Commission on the Profession, a commission I established, made up of both lawyers and lay people, to look at ethical behavior in the profession. And they have done groundbreaking work in court reform and in education of the legal profession itself with Jack's leadership. And finally, my sweetheart, Harriet Keisling's son, he'll remind you of the strong roots that his grandfather set down for civil justice and social justice in South Carolina when he came here. Harriet and Herbert certainly gave him a vision of what life as a just social change agent could be. His mayorship of Beaufort has just been an amazing thing, and whether it be new programs for the arts or new recognition of the place that Beaufort has played in the development of rights for African American citizens, or its history as the first colony in the first outpost in America, St. Helena, and the recent celebration in Beaufort of the Spanish heritage of this state, Billy does it all. With a so-called weak mayor form of government, he is a full-time mayor of Beaufort and has taken Beaufort to the next level. So this is a fabulous panel. I'll just... I'll just be one who can start, and I'm going to start with Billy, ask Billy to tell us about about his family and what they became in terms of very unusual Jewish politicians in the age of change. Billy, will start us off.
Sure. I guess I was very fortunate.
Can you make this mic louder, please?
Is it on?
Yes.
It's on. You just got to speak right into it.
Okay, I don't.
It doesn't look like it's on.
It doesn't sound like it's on.
Is there a
technical advisors?
That's on. Turned off.
Now,
is that better?
Yes, yeah, much.
That's it. Just like Justice Toe, all you can do is turn her off to turn her on. I guess I'm one of these guys who didn't have to learn about the civil rights movement because I really grew up in it. My grandfather came to Beaufort. Actually came to Walterboro, thank God. He came to Walterboro, thank goodness he came south to the water. But in 1888, as an 18-year-old who was running from the Tsar rather early for having organized in his school, he was smuggled out, went to Europe, and then of course to New York. Wanted to be a farmer and couldn't find a place big enough in the Lower East Side to plant his crop. So he headed south and ended up in Beaufort. He went to work for a cotton ginning farming company that he eventually led. But he lived and grew up and raised his kids on a little island called St. Helen Island, where there were about 10 white families and about 10,000 black families. He and his partner were the first two board members of Penn Center, then called Penn School, now called Penn Center, which was the first and only surviving, and Mary Mack, who's been chairman of the board and won every award they give to a person, knows that it is really the only surviving, and I think it's going to get some more national recognition before we know it. But he was a farmer on the Sea Islands, and he had opened and worked with black and white to create cooperatives. And so he had cooperatives all over Beaufort County. And his four brothers, who when he was made a partner in McDonald Wilkins Corporation, came and ran the country stores. So they were the postmasters, they were the money lenders, they had the gas stations. They sold people clothes and farming supplies, but they also helped them sell them. Out of my grandfather came my father. He had two sons, my father and my uncle Leon. They were split by the Depression. Leon went to Columbia University, to Harvard Law School, back to Columbia, and became in his 20s one of the brainchilds of the New Deal, where he worked for Senator Wagner, the Wagner Act, the Housing Act, Social Security Act, the Farm Act, etc. My father sold his blood for spending money at the College of Charleston. And then he went in the Navy, and he landed as a naval officer wearing a Marine Corps uniform, carrying a service revolver that no one ever told him how to use, with the 1st Marine Division at Guadalcanal. Just before that, he married my mother. You talk about a civil rights movement. A liberal New York Jew who ends up in Beaufort, South Carolina in the mid-1940s, who was afraid to talk to people, who didn't like to go to cocktail parties, who didn't like the country club, who didn't basically play Scrabble with her best friend in the afternoon and played four-handed piano in the mornings. Until 1974, when she said, I've got to do something. All my excuses for staying in Beaufort, meaning my children are gone, and I either go back to New York or I stay here and make it a place where my children might be able to come back. And she was the first woman elected to county council ever in Beaufort. It's interesting because Justice Toe, genius to some of us, where Jane was reminding me that the first piece and only piece of publicly paid for a sculpture that I'm aware of is a bust of Robert Smalls that she had commissioned when she was on county council. And while she got the county to pay for it, they wouldn't allow it to be on county property. So it sits in a church, which is the church that Smalls attended. But she went to the legislature And she was my good friend, Bud Ferrillo, guided her, and he introduced her to about five people who led her through. But the interesting thing about Harriet in the legislature was that on Thursday afternoons, when all of her friends went back to work, she started doing her research. And whatever the issue was that was going to be on the docket or on the calendar the next week, she would come back with her research papers and say, "Now you go say this stuff." But it turned out that she was able to get up there. But, you know, I in the piece I wrote, and I said earlier, I didn't have to learn the civil rights movement because I was fortunate that my grandfather, the immigrant who came to this country, which was good to him, planted a moral compass. And my father and my uncle, my aunts, my mother, me. And so I've never really had to think about right and wrong. I'm dyslexic. It's hard to read. I don't give speeches. I speak from my heart. I tell the truth, and I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong. And luckily, thanks to them, and the way I was brought up, and the environment where, as a child, we always went to Penn Center and met Dr. King and sat in on the civil rights training sessions, where later on we went and sat in on the leadership development programs where they brought African-American potential leaders from all the southern states. I didn't have to learn it. I just had to do what was right. And I have a great debt of gratitude to that grandfather who decided that living under the czar wasn't a good thing. And he found this wonderful place where we live, and I've had the opportunities to do the things that I've done.
Joel, you had a front row seat on the making of a lot of history as a youngster in your parents' household, and then you began to make it yourself. So tell us what that was like.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and thank you for that kind introduction. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, and I have such a great empathy for this organization that my father and Richard Gergel worked to start many years ago. So, of course, I would be remiss if I did not introduce my mom. Mom, stand up so everybody can see you. She snuck in. My wife of 26 years and the mother of our two children, Becky Lurie. And my mother-in-law of 26 years, Pam Baum. And my brother-in-law, Gary Baum. So, Chief, I was thinking about this all week. And, of course, you know, I had a friend of mine who recently passed away who once said, the only kind of jeans you can change are Levi's. And I think that applies to, can you hear me better, Moss? Okay. I think that certainly applies to my brothers and I. We developed our sense of compassion and social justice and sensitivity through both my mother and my father. I also inherited allergies and asthma and all that other kind of stuff. So growing up in that household, I'm going to kind of jump from growing up to a little bit of recent history because I think it all ties in together, Chief. Of course, you know, my dad was elected in 1964. He ran in 1960. Back during those days, Jack, you may recall, you would have like the top five vote getters on the House delegation. I think he was number six. So he sat out a year and then ran in 1964 and served in the House from 64 to 72, and then in the state senate from 72 to 92. And so my brothers and I just grew up in a house that was filled with a lot of political conversation and a lot of struggles for social justice. I can tell you, as a small child growing up in, you know, on Pine Belt Road near Bradley Elementary School, that there were a lot of not so nice phone calls that would come into our house with a lot of mean people that would say very ugly things. I can remember campaigning for him in one of his re-elections. I could have been in fifth grade knocking on doors, and I remember an old gentleman sitting in a rocking chair, and I walked up and I said, I appreciate you consider voting for my dad, Isidore Lurie, and him telling me he wouldn't vote for that man if he was the last Jew on earth. And of course, you know, I came back and told my dad he wanted to go find him and yell at him and all that kind of stuff. But I remember so much about what Dad taught us. And, you know, if you go back, Chief, you may recall that when Speaker Blatt was Speaker, Dad, during his first term, was very disappointed. What year were you elected to the House?
74. Okay. Blatt had just been defeated by your father's Young Turks and forced to become Speaker Emeritus. And he sat on that back row grumping about every progressive thing we did.
Well, you may recall. So did you come in with IS and Felder and all that?
No, they came in 2 years before
72.
I did.
72, okay. So in anyway, when Dad was first elected to the House, one of the first things he noticed is that when the school children come in, school children still come up to the gallery, and we take a moment in the House and Senate and introduce them, they would only introduce the white students. And he was very disturbed by that. And he was hell-bent on not being part of that. And he changed that. He was one of the first to hire an African-American page in the House of Representatives. So he was somewhat of a trailblazer in making things happen. I mean, it wasn't about just talking the talk. He would make things happen. And, of course, you know, during a very turbulent 60s and 70s, people like Dad, Justice Toll, and others were that important bridge between the black and white communities to really move this state forward. In 1972, it was the first time ever we had elected African-Americans to the House of Representatives. People like I.S. Levy Johnson, Herbert Fielding. And my father would go door-to-door in Columbia for I.S. in the white neighborhoods of Shannon and Forest Acres. And you can imagine what that would be like today, sometimes much less 50 years ago. So, I mean, he was really about living through a time, working through a time, to really ensure that all people had a seat at the table. His core issues that he passed on to me and my legislative work and my brothers who are lawyers was to always be a voice for those that didn't have a voice. And so I'll kind of bring that forward a little bit because I want to make sure there's plenty of time to answer questions and our other panelists. But I was thinking about driving down here, and I was watching Senator Rubin's picture up on the screen earlier with Dr. Donaldson, who, by the way, I'm sorry we came in on the tail end of this conversation because it was just awesome. Last summer, Wednesday, June 17th, Senator Katrina Sheely and I, Katrina's a Republican from Lexington, I'm a Democrat from Richland, very close friends. There are now two women in the Senate. At that time, she was the only woman in the Senate. We had worked for years on reforming the Department of Social Services, Reverend, and uh-huh. You, if you follow that issue, you know a couple of years ago, we had a very serious crisis on our hands. And so she and I were both honored to be co-recipients of the Community Relations Council Hyman Rubin Award, sort of their humanitarian award. And my daughter came in from Nashville, and my mom and Becky and Sam and our whole family, some of my colleagues in my business, had this nice luncheon at the convention center. And that whole day, I had pondered, Moss, about the progress or lack thereof that our state and our community has made since my dad served. I mean, I grew up in a time where Dad campaigned for I.D. Quincy Newman. Dad campaigned for I.S. Levy Johnson. Great social progress made, in my opinion, in the 70s and the early 80s. And yet, you couldn't deny that we've made progress around this country or we would not have a president in Barack Obama. But I would also argue in many ways we are more divided today than we were 40 years ago. You still see, in many cases, whites and blacks living in separate neighborhoods. And you still see private schools today predominantly white in the South. And anyway, I was very disturbed by that all day. But I didn't say anything because I didn't want to be a buzzkill at my own, you know, award ceremony. That night at 9:15, I get a text. And all the Senate Democrats, there ain't but 18 of us, so we stick pretty closely together. All the Senate Democrats are on one text line. And I just helped Rachel pack her car to go back to Nashville. And there was a text from Marlon Kempson, senator from Charleston, very good friend of mine. His father's a good friend of my dad's. He said, urgent, shooting at Mother Emanuel. Anybody talk to Clem? And I just sat, literally was just sitting down to flip on my laptop. And then right after that, Senator Ronnie Saab from Williamsburg called me. He said, Joel, have you heard anything? I said, no. He said, should we go down there? I said, I don't know what I don't know. Let's see if we can't figure out what's going on. And over the next 15 minutes, it became very apparent that this was more than just a drive-by shooting knocking out a couple of church windows. And we had some friends on the scene very quickly who were working with law enforcement and realized that there were nine people, one of them our desk mate and colleague, that were shot and killed in that incident. And by the way, on a side note, I've known Clem Pinckney since I served in the House in 98. We were in the House together. We were in the Senate together. We sat right next to each other in the Health and Human Services Finance Subcommittee. Both of us are very interested in issues like health care, Department of Mental Health, Medicaid, social services. This is the small subcommittee that would write that budget. So I was with them that morning, okay? And then my desk is right where Reverend Lair is. It's me, Vincent Shaheen, and him. So I mean, we would see each other and converse every day. And so that night we get this call, and the world is upside down. And the next morning, a few of us meet in Senator Leatherman's office to decide, Chief, whether we're going in session or not going in session. A lot of debate about what the appropriate, respectful thing to do is, and we decide to go on in that morning and have a service in his memory. And we start the service by playing a speech he gave only a month or two earlier on the Walter Scott shooting down in Charleston, which was an incredible speech. If you've never seen that speech, go to YouTube and Google Clem Pinckney Walter Scott speech, because you will capture the essence of who this great man really was. So we played that speech. Several of us, myself included, went to the podium and talked about Clem and our relationship with him. And then they took us by Senate Security, rushed us over to Bethel AME Church. Lonnie Brailsford, a longtime friend of mine, was having a service. All the AME churches across the country were having a service at noon that day. And they ushered us into the front row. And I'll tell you, for the first time as an adult, I really had to check myself and see if I was living through a nightmare, a civil rights movie like Mississippi Burning. Because there I was on the front row of an African-American church, incredible service taking place, mourning the loss of a black friend killed by a white racist running around with a Confederate flag. And I just really felt like Hollywood could not have scripted something this awful. And needless to say, I was proud to be the first. As you know, I'll tell you one other interesting side note. In our faith, we sit with a body when it returns to the funeral home until the funeral. So we came back in session the next Tuesday in preparation. We were going to have Senator Pinckney's body lie in state. And I stood up and told the other 45 senators how we handle a loved one in a funeral home, and we decided to stand with Senator Pinckney the moment his body arrived in the state house to the moment he left. And Senator Vincent Shaheen and I were his first two escorts. And that day, there must have been 4,000 people that lined up on a hot June day in coat and tie. I met people from Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, who drove all the way to Columbia to pay their respects. And then, of course, you know, the funeral was that Friday, and we all came down. And the next week, we took the flag down. And, you know, to be, for me, it was a way to see that even in the darkest of hours, that the light can shine again. And I'm very sorry that it took such a terrible tragedy, but I was very proud to be part of it. Anyway, thank you to be here today, and look forward to seeing you.
Thanks very much, Joel. So moving and so well said. Marvin, I want to turn it to you now and give us your perspective as a longtime social activist.
Thank you very much, Gene. Good to be with you all. I'm going to pick up a few loose ends, even as I represent some of the loose ends that have been referred to earlier, of sort of inheriting some of the movements that June was already in. Thank you, Moss. And also the theme which is to be emphasized today of ecumenism and interfaith. And I want you to notice the little lapel pin that I have on that I haven't worn for a good while. But that's the symbol we created for Community Care Incorporated when I came here in 1969. And our graphics showing the black and the white coming together at real cost of blood, of the red. The graphic that we developed showed the various faith traditions and the various heritage coming together and flowing together in that one symbol. So that's always meant a lot to me, and meant a lot to the kinds of things I've been involved in across the years with the support of so many of you. I'm going to pick up a number of loose ends that Bobby referred to, as we have a number of times, to Senator Hyman Rubin. And a colleague of mine that worked for me for a number of years before she went to work in the state legislature with Senator Rubin, Keller Barron, I called her last night and said, well, now, Keller, I know about Senator Rubin's involvement in the community and in so many personal ways, but I've sort of lost track of something of his legislative record and some of the things that he stood for and accomplished. So she emailed me that he was a major founder of the Homestead Exemption Act to give a break to persons over 65. He was on the Committee on Aging with before Governor Riley was governor. And Governor Riley was the chairperson of the Committee on Aging, along with Isidore Lurie. And some of the things which they accomplished was the Living Will, or Death with Dignity Act. And they got it passed through the Senate, but it failed in the House. And then they had to, next year, had to go back again and get it through the Senate and through the House. But you know what a tremendous piece of humanity and caring that is for all of us, especially as we age a bit, we're a bit more aware of it and all. But that requires that hospitals and healthcare facilities use healthcare power of attorneys and those kinds of things. So, again, championing the causes of the elderly and the needy in our communities. And another of his accomplishments, major accomplishments, was to introduce in the Senate Finance Committee the founding of the State Museum. We sort of take that for granted, don't we? But it's here and one of the records of a great man like he. Now I want to share a little bit of the personal side of my experience with him. Some of you who are from Columbia or have been from across the years are probably acquainted with the Luncheon Club. And this is an interracial luncheon group that's been meeting since the early 60s. President Jones, president of the university, and Senator Rubin were talking about how they could help integrate the community, and they decided, well, by power de force, they could probably get a black or two into some of the civic clubs and that kind of thing, but it would be fairly token and that kind of thing. So they decided, as Senator Rubin told me in a few months before he died, that we just form a club of our own. And it was called the Luncheon Club. But, he says, it is a misnomer. It ought to be called the Goodwill Club. And I asked him, and now, who was that professor at USC that you said Goodwill was the noblest? And he picked it up and said, Dr. Josiah Morse. Goodwill is the purest jewel of morality. And we heard that so many times from his lips as he closed the Luncheon Club meetings and many other occasions. Bobby mentioned earlier about the outstanding record of Dr. Josiah Morris at USC and his leadership throughout the nation. And he mentioned just in passing that his name was originally Moses. And Senator Rubin confided to me, or shared with me, that when Josiah Moses graduated from one of the Ivy League schools, he could not get a job anywhere in this country in academia, until he changed his name from Moses to Morris. And he ended up here in South Carolina. Another little tidbit. Oh, and I need to tell you what I'm working from here. When I was approaching retirement in 2003, one of your panelists tomorrow, Bill Saunders, and I were in a meeting together in Columbia, And he heard I was going to retire, and so said, "Well, Marvin, what are you going to do when you retire?" And I gave him my standard joke. I said, "Well, I'm going to read a third of my time, and travel a third of my time, and write a third of my time, and garden a third of my time." He went right past the joke and said, "Well, what are you going to write about?" And I said, "Well, I ought to do some writing about the luncheon club, but also there are some theological things I want to write on and all." And he said, "Well, I've been doing some writing about the Charleston hospital strike." And as many of you know, he was the main negotiator with Governor McNair that resolved the issues of the Charleston hospital strike in 68 and 69 and accomplished bringing minimum wage to South Carolina, not just for the hospitals and not just the solving of some of many of those issues. But so that day on the way home from talking with Bill, it just occurred to me that just like Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation, that how many of the civil rights leaders are rapidly passing from the scene. And I pulled over off the interstate in that emergency lane where you're not supposed to stop, you know, and wrote down in my notebook, "Anthology of Civil Rights in South Carolina." And I talked with him a week or two later about it, and he said, "No, that can't be that. It's got to be civil and human rights." And so in retirement, I'm working on, as many of you know, a five-volume work of champions of civil and human rights in South Carolina, over 130 interviews with civil rights leaders across the state. I did about 100 of them myself, but another 30 or 40 are from people like Jack Bass back here and others and so on that we've been able to pull together, and the South Carolina University of South Carolina Press will be publishing the first volume the end of the year. And in case you're interested, my cards are on the table out here with my address and phone number on one side and champions on the other, so feel free to pick them up and stay in touch. And in addition to just putting out a book, because it's not my book, it's our book, we really have to capture that history before it's gone. And if we're talking about tools to address the current critical needs of change and incivility in so many quarters and so on, we and our children and our grandchildren have to know the stories of where these things came from and who suffered and worked and all to accomplish this. I'm going to read just one other brief passage from an interview. This, many of you know, Bishop Fred James. And he was, in an interview with him, he recounted that the Lurie family, especially Saul Lurie, has always been devoted to the community and to the community's welfare. He said, the Lurie family, Saul Lurie was devoted to his store. And when he moved it from St. George to Columbia in about 1949, it was that year that Marian Anderson was coming to Columbia to sing at the Township Auditorium. And you've heard this before? Yeah. And so she and Reverend James was put in charge of gathering the ushers for the event. And he recruited 38 women in evening gowns and proceeded to try to get tuxedos for 48 gentlemen. And he went from place to place and no luck. And then he decided, well, he'd try this new store down this the street. And when he went in, Collette looked him up and down and said, "How many do you need?" And he said, 48. He said, "Well, we'll have to open some new boxes." So that was just characteristic of so many of the traditions that the Rubens and others. And got more stories, but I'll pass it on for now.
Thanks, Marvin. Jack Swirling, a former greatness at Clemson University, when little guys like him could still play football, is best cleanup hitter I know. So, Jack, how about give us your perspective on what it was like for a young lawyer to begin to interact with some of the greats in Jewish life that changed the civil rights complexion of South Carolina.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for me to be here. See so many friends in the audience. And, Moss, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, we'll make sure. Okay. I'd like to introduce my wife of 46 years, Erica Helfer. We got married when she was 15. So it's light, Erica. Anyway, I met, I'm from New Jersey. Before you hiss and boo, but I was born in the Bronx, grew up in New Jersey, and in 1964 I graduated high school, which makes me, I think next month, 70 years old if I can count that high. And when I decided I wanted to go to Clemson, why, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed a good place to go. All right, we got a few Clemson folks here. All right. But I decided to go to Clemson, and some people said I just got lost on I-85. But anyway, I did go to Clemson, and when I told my mother I was going to go to Clemson, she was appalled. Why? Because my father was a drill instructor at Fort Bragg during World War II. And my mother went to live with him down at Fort Bragg during the war. He was stationed there for 3 years. And she remembered that at Fort Bragg, go to a restaurant, the signs were up, there were racial epithets about Afro-Americans, none of them, and I'm not gonna use the word, no Jews and no dogs. And that was my mother's recollection of the South from the 40s. So it took a little, I had to do a lot of convincing that it was going to be okay. I went down to Clemson. Fortunately, I came home with a Jewish girl. She was amazed that I would be able to find a Jewish girl. But the Jewish girl was from Brooklyn. And if you're from the Bronx, Brooklyn is, you know. But Erica's family came down to South Carolina in the late 50s. Anyway, when I went to Clemson, for the most part, I was well received. I mean, there were a lot of folks there from New Jersey and New York, Pennsylvania. But there were a lot of folks there who were still very conservative. And they did not particularly want us there, particularly those of the Jewish faith. I ran for president of the freshman class in 1964, and there were signs up that said, "Don't vote for the Yankee Jew," with swastikas. So that was my welcome to the South. But that changed. It started changing, and Harvey Gantt had just gone to Clemson in 1963. When I went to Clemson, and Erica came a year after I, when Erica's first year, there were 5 Afro-Americans there. There were 2 young men, one from Charleston, Aaron Harvey, whose father was a magistrate here. I know some of you may know him. And there was a Larry Grant, I think, Erica. And then there were 3 Afro-American black girls. And guess who became their friends? Eric and I. So I guess I was one of the original Northern agitators that came to South Carolina. Not only that, but I organized a intramural baseball and football team of Yankees who would play the dining hall staff, which is all Afro-American. And so I was agitating everybody I could. Clemson at that time in the 64, 65, as you know, was like any other place, was just in turmoil between the war and civil rights issues. And we all got a real education when you grew up in the 60s. And I know a number of you here grew up in the 60s as well. I decided to stay in South Carolina. I went back up to New York for 2 years. Eric and I got married in 1970, and then I decided to come back to law school in South Carolina. And I didn't realize, I knew some of the Clemson folks that I'd gone to school with, but I didn't know a lot of people. In 1973, when I graduated law school, I had the privilege of getting hired by Phil Wittenberg down in Sumter. His office at that time was in Sumter, South Carolina. He was practicing with Wendell Levi, who was 93 years old at that time, and came to the office every single day. Stanley Applebaum, some of you may know, and Sam Abrams. So it was an all-Jewish law firm in Sumter, South Carolina. And I found out at that point that there were about 40 members of the Sumter Bar, half of which could trace their roots back to Judaism. So it was fascinating. Bernie Warshauer was a judge down there. And there were a number of people, some of them you know. I stayed there for 6 months. Erica did not want to move to Sumter because we had a dog. And there were no apartment complexes in Sumter that allowed a dog. So we had to stay in Columbia, and Mr. Wittenberg didn't like that very much, that I was going to stay in Columbia and not come to Sumter to work. I was going to work there, but I wasn't going to live there. So I left, and actually it became one of the big breaks in my life as I met Isidore Lurie. And I had not known Isidore until 1973. I was out of work for about 2 or 3 months, and I got offered a job by one of his partners, Tom Curley. And then I met Isidore, and Isidore changed my life. Isidore was my hero. He was my second father. He was my champion. He was my mentor. He taught me many, many things that I carry with me to this day. He was a great man, and his family was great. I think Joel at that time was about 10. He's now 53, so I really knew that. Susan, of course, was about 15 or 16 at that time, too. And, of course, we became very close, Susan and Isidore and Eric and I and a number of other folks in Columbia. But I, as the chief said, I call her the chief. I don't call her Jean. I call her the chief. Because I'm a lawyer, you know, chief. But at any rate, when I really got to sit at the feet of some of the great leaders of South Carolina's civil rights, Isidore was one of the Young Turks. He was elected to the Senate in 1972. I went there, I got a job with him in 1973. The people who traveled through our office were the Gressets and the Blotts and the Dennises and the Rileys and the Alexanders, the Hyman Rubens. They all came through our office. And I got to meet them at a very young age. I was, 25 years old, and I was meeting these people who were the lions of the South Carolina Bar and the South Carolina Legislature. I got to meet Gene Toll, whose husband actually was my contracts professor in 1970, and he gave me a B. Never did forgive him for that. But they've been close friends since that time as well. But imagine a 25-year-old lawyer being at the feet of these individuals. And, you know, I'd sit, sometimes I'd go and sit in the room. I'd be allowed to sit in the room. Other times I wasn't allowed to sit in the room when certain things were discussed. But over those years, I got to see the Young Turks, who are the progressive politicians in South Carolina, the ones that wanted to change the social agenda, the ones that were no longer complacent about the rights that minorities had, the rights that the elderly had, the rights that the incapacitated had. And these folks were the ones who decided to go ahead and do something about it. The old guard no longer, the power was passing from the old guard to the Young Turks and the new generation coming in. Like Joel said and the chief said, Isidore was instrumental in getting the first two black legislators elected since Reconstruction, Jim Felder and I.S. Levy Johnson. He was instrumental in getting Afro-Americans hired in the city government, in the county government, getting them to work at the courthouses. He and Hyman Rubin, I don't want to leave out Senator Rubin because he also was instrumental in that. But I got to witness all that and hear it all, and it was just fascinating for me. And I took it with me all through my life. I mean, I'm now turning 70, been practicing law for 43 years, and I still carry with that, with me, everything that those men taught me, including Isidore, mostly Isidore, and of course Hyman Rubin as well, who I also knew, and Phil Wittenberg as well. I grew up in a household, my father was he was a tough guy. He grew up on the Lower East Side of New York. But one thing that he taught me was that, you know, I was a Jew, and I've always had a very strong identity as a Jew. I've never lost that identity as a Jew, and have never felt any less identity as a Jew in all my entire life. But my father taught me, because I was a Jew, I needed to fight for the underdog. I was expected to fight for the underdog. That was my role, and my father always fought for the underdog, and he passed that on to me. And so I've spent the last 43 years doing what I think I enjoy doing. Even it's criminal work, I do criminal work, but I really try and fight for the underdog and give them, let them fight on an equal plane when they're accused of a crime. And I believe, and I try to fulfill my role every day, every single day, and don't feel in any way that I've ever not fulfilled my role, because I can put my head on my pillow every single night, and even though I've lost cases, I know that I've done my best. I continue to fight for those kinds of causes, and attribute a lot of that to Isidore, Susan, and Susan, and we, as I said, we were very close. Joel and I are very close. I've watched Joel grow up and be just an incredible politician himself. When he stands up and talks, I hear his daddy talking. And that makes me feel good, because I laughed with Isidore and I cried with Isidore. And Isidore could cry. He was a real man. He really was. He was emotional. And if you knew him, he could be a very emotional individual, both pro and con. But he taught me a lot and taught a lot of other people a lot for my generation. So I'm proud to be here.
I now ask each of you panelists to reflect on this. As we look ahead after the tragedy at Emanuel, I wonder what priorities you see for political action. And I ask you to think about that in this context. There's a big decline in Jewish leadership at the state level of government in South Carolina right now. And so I wonder whether we are losing energy for progressive causes. So I throw that out for you panelists. Billy, would you like to take a little crack at that?
You know, I think it's very.
Hold it right to you.
It's you know, I don't know anybody. Excuse me, Joel, who would go into the state legislature again if they're in the right mind. I stood it for 4 years, but what I found out personally is that local government, those boards and commissions, doing the nuts and bolts of what improves people's lives, is where the exciting government is. And if you look at polling research data, you'll find, it's not me, but you'll find across the board that mayors enjoy a 70% plus approval rating. And that's not because we're special, it's because we listen, we talk, we're civil, we keep a conversation going. And so, Gene, I think you're right, but I think if you begin to look at the lower levels, which are my hope for the future, is that people who are paving roads and fixing potholes and figuring out how to deal with a government that is broken near the top is really going to be the hope.
Joel, as we see a lot of white South Carolinians move towards the Republican Party, maybe a few African Americans, where does that leave Jewish Democrats in public life in South Carolina?
Chief, that's a tough question. Right now there are two of us. There's my dear friend, and she's like a sister to me, Representative Beth Bernstein, who represents my old house district in the in Richland County, and of course myself. I'm retiring this year after 18 years. One of the two candidates running for my seat is Susan Brill, who is Susan Allian, who grew up in Columbia.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, we may continue to keep somebody of our faith in the Senate. You know, I think the issue, though, to be honest with you, is a little bit greater than whether there are Jews in the legislature. I think the issue is whether there are progressives. And I worry about the divide, particularly in the South. And I'll give you an example, and it's not really... One good example I could give you. Switch gears on social justice. Let's talk about roads. Okay. Our roads are the crappiest in the country, all right? I mean, they're horrible. We already face an underfunded healthcare system, a public education system, a judicial system. Our judges work harder than any judges in the country. And so the only way you're ever going to fix our roads is you're going to have to create a new source of revenue, which you, if you kept up with this issue, I've been very strongly outspoken for. And the simplest way to do it is to raise the gasoline tax, which is the third lowest in the country. Okay. So let me translate that to you. If I did a poll right now, I spoke with Scott Huffman at Winthrop University 2 weeks ago. 55%+ of South Carolinians, probably more, would say they're for raising the gasoline tax, just like they were for raising the cigarette tax. Here's the challenge. First of all, you have a governor who has put her foot down and said she would veto it. Okay, so that starts you off, you know, you're down a couple of scores there. Secondly, I represent one of the few swing districts left in South Carolina. There are 170 legislators, 46 senators, 124 House members. I sat down with a reporter the other day. We identified 8 swing districts. That means a district that's held by a member of one party where hypothetically another party could be elected, okay? Because our districts, through reapportionment, are either majority white or majority black. Okay, and in the South, what that typically means is the majority white are going to be Republican and the majority black are going to be Democratic. My district, when I first ran, was about 23% African American. It's up much higher than that now due to some demographic changes in Northeast Columbia. Here's the challenge. I got a lot of good friends, Republicans that I serve with in the Senate. Okay, won't call any by name. They represent 100,000 people just like I do. But elections are no longer in November. Okay, they're in June. Forget about November elections. Nobody cares about November elections anymore. They're in June. My Republican friends don't have to answer to a general electorate where 55-60% would support a gasoline tax. They got to answer to the 6,000 or 7,000 99% white voters that show up at the polls in a June primary, half of them which think Donald Trump should be king of the universe. That's the problem. And until we figure out another way to redraw districts, and it would suit me fine to let the courts draw them, an independent panel of judges draw it like they do in California and Arizona, I have a lot of concern. I feel bad I'm leaving at what I don't think is a great time for South Carolina. I mean, I've got a business that's growing. I'm 53. I've done it 18 years. You're right, Billy. I don't think I can do it anymore, okay? Because I've never viewed public service as a career, but more as a sacrifice and a contribution. But I do worry that at some point, how does the pendulum swing back to the middle? And there's so many reasons I could give you, both local and national, about it. Same thing as in Washington. Used to be that members of Congress would debate and they'd go out and have drinks together. Some of the best work ever done in this country in my lifetime is when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House and Ronald Reagan was President, Newt Gingrich was Speaker, and Bill Clinton was President, because they could compromise. Now if the Republicans compromise with Obama, they're considered traitors. And unfortunately, the far left is the same way. If the Democrats want to compromise with Mitch McConnell, in many ways, they're viewed the same way. I think that's really what's ripping our political system apart. And so I worry not so much whether there'll be, I've really hopped around, whether there'll be future Jewish people in the South Carolina General Assembly, but people that are willing to stand up and speak out and not worry about political consequences. This week's transgender bathroom issue is a great example. I mean, you know, I'm not opposed to that bill because of the economics. The economics are terrible. I'm opposed to that bill because it singles out a group of people. It treats them in a very hateful way, and it's discrimination in a new form. And that's what we're all about. So.
I know we are very close, if not a little over our allotted time, but I want to give a chance for maybe just a couple of audience questions before we break. Yes, ma'am.
What would it take to get Medicaid expanded in this state?
I can speak to that.
What? All right. Joel, I know this. That's Joel's heartstring.
I mean, I could talk to you for... There's a good example, and my friend Daryl Jackson, by the way, I want to show you a picture real quick. This picture on the Jack's article is one of my favorite pictures, because in that article is my father embracing Fred James, who Reverend Laird talked about, and Bishop Andrew Jackson, who is Daryl Jackson's father. In the very back, up on the podium, this is pictures from 1992, is a very young Daryl Jackson who was just elected to the Senate in my father's seat, and I was his campaign manager, and I'm standing next to him. So there's a lot of history for me, my friend Daryl Jackson, and our families in this picture. The bottom line, the governor could do it with the strike of a pen. There are 200,000 South Carolinians that are being denied health care simply because they live in South Carolina. If they lived in 31 other states, including our southern partners like Louisiana, most recently Arkansas, Kentucky, they would have health care. And I could explain this to you in a long, because I work in this market, and I see people that make, if you make less than 100% of the federal poverty level, you don't qualify for a subsidy under Obamacare. So there's a great article that Andy Brack's newspaper wrote yesterday, and I was probably a little bit too on point, but I said at the end of the day, the working poor are the ones getting screwed in this debate.
So what would it take?
It would take two things. Either the governor, and we have begged and pleaded and worked with her, and we talk a lot about if she wanted to really do something for South Carolina, taking that flag down is important, but she could sign an executive order to accept Medicaid, or it would take a two-thirds vote of both houses. We're going to talk about it, but until she leaves office, we don't have the votes.
All right. How about one more question before we adjourn our discussion? Well, Lily, we are so privileged, the five of us, to have been included in this very historic discussion. Thanks to you and to the Society for putting on this very, very brilliant discussion of an extremely important discussion about history and the future. God bless.